I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. When Nelson Mandela received the Philadelphia Liberty Medal in 1993, he said, quote, "In the struggle for real change and a just peace, we will have to overcome the terrible heritage of the insult to human dignity, the inequalities, the conflicts, and antagonisms that are the true expression of the apartheid system." That was just 3 years after Mandela had been released from 27 years in prison. He shared that medal and the Nobel Peace Prize that year with F.W. de Klerk. A year later, Mandela became the first black president of South Africa and led the country's transition to a multiracial democracy. Nelson Mandela died last night at the age of 95, and today the world mourns his loss and remembers his extraordinary life and accomplishments. We begin our conversation about Nelson Mandela with Mary Frances Berry, University of Pennsylvania history professor. She is the former chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, co-founded the Free South Africa movement back in 1984, and was in Cape Town in 1990 when Mandela was set free. She was last a guest on Radio Times in 2009. For her book, And Justice for All. Mary Frances Berry, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for asking me.
You're very welcome. Nelson Mandela, as we know, lived this rich and long life. How should we remember him?
Well, I think that all of the encomiums and the recognition of his moral authority are good, and we expect those at this time. And no one lives forever, so I have to accept that he's passed. For to me, he was not just a hero, but also a friend. But I think that the other thing we ought to remember is what Mandela was trying to achieve. He wanted South Africa to be a viable nation in the world. And he looked around him during the time that he was in prison and when he got out and when he became president, he looked around him at what was happening elsewhere in Africa. And although morally one might think that economically the poor people should have been distributed more property, or there should be some kind of change in the economy in South Africa to take care of those who had been so long deprived, he knew that he couldn't make any massive change in the economy. What he wanted to do was to avoid a bloodbath, have reconciliation, form a basis on which the country could move forward even after he was gone. And so he saw himself as healing the nation and keeping the nation together for its future and not letting it fly apart.
As you mentioned, he was a friend of yours. What was Nelson Mandela like? What was he like as a friend?
Mandela was a funny guy. We often forget that great leaders have a sense of humor.
It's good to know that, actually.
He had a sense of humor. And he liked to watch old sitcoms on television. Things like The Honeymooners and
Alice to the Moon, right?
If anybody remembers.
I do.
Any of those. And so he had a great sense of humor, and he had a twinkle in his eye. I remember the first time I saw him when he got out of prison, and we were there in Cape Town, and he came in the room with Winnie Mandela, to whom he was married all those years. And we had not seen him in person, only photographs during all the time that we struggled to end apartheid. And he came in, and he smiled, and he looked so like a fine, wonderful, healthy man, and we were all thinking he was going to be decrepit. And he had a twinkle in his eye and went around and hugged everybody, and he was always that way. He was down to earth. He was a hero, and he knew in terms of his public persona what he had to do and how he should carry himself as a matter of principle for the goals that he wanted. But when he was with people who were his friends, he was a down-to-earth guy. Yeah. I mean, he was often that way in public, too.
Well, I also read that he, especially with women, was kind of a flirt.
Well, if you call a twinkle in his eye and sort of a smile flirting, but if it was flirting, it was quite attractive.
Quite attractive, indeed. And for
the other thing, Marty,
yeah,
I want
to
make sure people remember,
sure,
is that Nelson Mandela was not always loved politically here in the United States. And when we started the Free South Africa movement and all those campaigns to get sanctions and to end apartheid, there was hostility everywhere. It took a movement to get the United States policy to change from hostility and support for apartheid and no thought of ever releasing Mandela from prison or any of the other of his comrades who were in jail for their opposition to the regime, and all the people who were killed in various massacres that took place in South Africa. And American policy supported South Africa all those years. And so what had to happen is we had to change our policy, and along with Europe and other countries and the people around this country, including in Philadelphia, at the campuses and people in the community, joined the Free South Africa movement when we started it. And we all demanded that divestment. We all demanded sanctions. And we had to struggle. And when we finally got the bill passed, the President Reagan vetoed it. And then we had to go and march and protest and go to jail for another year. Every day in order to get it passed again over his veto. So we should not in this country today, where we say, oh, what a great man was Mandela and we're glad apartheid is over, think that America has always been on the right side. It was one of those cases where we weren't on the right side and should have been all those years.
Do you see that then as a kind of bottom-up movement that helped to get Nelson Mandela out of prison? And we should say that he also kind of negotiated his way out of prison as well.
Yeah, well, absolutely. If there had been no sanctions, and everyone, all of the scholars who look at this and the people who study this know that if there had been no sanctions, and if the West had not turned against South Africa, there were sanctions, the UN passed the sanctions, other European countries did, and here in the United States, we as the major power in the world were the last bastion to fall, and our administration kept saying they were constructively engaging the South African government. But until the people in this country moved and said, demanded that Congress pass sanctions, and you had it done on a bipartisan basis. People like, we talk about polarization today, there was a complete bipartisan response, positive response to the Free South Africa movement. Senator Kassebaum, Nancy Kassebaum from Kansas, was one of the leaders in supporting this. And so we got a bill passed, we got sanctions, and the sanctions started to bite. And when I went to South Africa after they had been in place all that time and the sanctions had started to bite, it was at that point that he was released. So it was not the only factor, but I just don't want people to think that American policy has always been, and we as Americans have always been in love with Nelson Mandela and supported him all of his life and thought he was a great guy, because that's not true.
You know, there's so many quotes that I could quote on the radio from Nelson Mandela, and one that really stuck out for me, Mary Frances Berry, is he said, "The oppressor must be liberated just as surely as the oppressed," talking about apartheid and talking about how apartheid was hurting white South Africa as much as it was, maybe not as much, but in a different kind of way and in a serious kind of way, the way it was hurting black South Africa.
Well, it's the same principle that has been seen in other nonviolent movements and philosophies. Martin Luther King said that. All the leaders in the civil rights movement, we all understood that. People understood that the whites in America were hurt as much as blacks were by the continued Jim Crow and segregation and repression. And any time you oppress people, the oppressor is harmed, although they may not understand it, as much as the people who they are oppressing. And I think that he of course, believed in that kind of philosophy. And he was consciously admonishing the people to understand that.
He, for a while, and this is another quote, and the ANC had been around for a while, for decades actually, trying to address the inequities in South Africa using nonviolence. And back in 1961, he says, there's no moral goodness using an ineffective weapon, perhaps expressing his frustration with nonviolence.
Yeah, at one point in his career, and at that point, he decided to espouse violence. for a time, being so terribly frustrated. He went through many changes, as did the entire movement in South Africa and the ANC, in trying to, both politically and materially, in trying to do something to end apartheid. And it was frustrating because they never seemed to, he was arrested, put in jail, all sorts of things happened to them, prosecuted several times, and not just him, but the other guys who were the leaders in this movement. And so it was out of frustration that he said that, yes. Mm.
Well, and it, you know, it must be just said over and over again that he spent 27 years in prison, many of those years on Robben Island. But I got the feeling in some of the things that he wrote and others have said about him is that he learned, I guess, so much about leadership and the kind of leader he became from some of those experiences in prison.
Yes, a suffering breeds character. Yeah. And for him, the suffering, out of the suffering, he got clearer understanding about things and what was necessary to be a leader if he ever got out. Because at first he didn't know for sure he was going to get out, of course, or when he would get out. But I think that he used that time well, and the time used him very well.
Mm. And I read as well that at his inauguration he invited one of his white guards to be there at that ceremony.
Oh, yeah. That was all... Part of it is the way Nelson Mandela felt about people and his sincere beliefs about other human beings. And part of it was his strategic understanding of what was necessary to make his country able to go forward and to make people accept each other enough to build toward the future. And he was willing to do almost anything to have that happen. And to show, be a symbol. He was aware of his symbolic importance in the process of getting the country to move on.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye here, but he also appeared to be such a pragmatic and skilled politician.
Oh, he was. That's why when sometimes I hear people talking about what a mellow man he was, and a loving, kind, and he probably just had goodness in his heart and didn't plan anything ahead of time or think through. He was strategic. He was absolutely strategic in his thinking about what was good for the country and which way to go forward and what steps to take, even on small things. And he was right about, you know, he took the time to think and he figured things out and he did what he thought would move the ball forward. And each time he was right.
Well, Mary Frances Berry, I so appreciate the fact that you joined us today on Radio Times to talk about your friend, Nelson Mandela.
All right. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. University of Pennsylvania history professor. She's the former chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, co-founded the Free South Africa Movement. This was back in 1984, and she was in Cape Town in 1990 when Nelson Mandela was set free. And again, a guest on Radio Times a couple of years ago for a book that she wrote called And Justice for All. We have Trudy Rubin waiting in the wing. She interviewed Nelson Mandela in 2000. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AT&T Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. From the creative team that brought you This Is the Week That Is and our show of shows, AT&T Productions celebrates the holidays with its newest original production, The Big Time, New Vaudeville for the Holidays, featuring Jennifer Childs, Scott Greer, and Dave Jadico. The Big Time reunites Philadelphia's comedy dream team and brings the steamer trunk circuit into the 21st century. Tickets at 1812productions.org. As the calendar pages fall away and 2013 comes to an end, you might be thinking of how to get that last-minute tax deduction. Whether you make a sustaining gift, have your employer match your gift, donate your car, or make a direct IRA rollover to WHYY, time is running out to make a tax-deductible donation. Explore the many ways to support WHYY. Call 1-888-345-WHYY or visit whyy.org/support.
the latest healthcare developments,
how what happens in Washington affects you,
how world events affect us all.
The news continues throughout your day. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are your co-hosts for Here and Now. Breaking news, thoughtful analysis, surprising interviews in the middle of your day.
With voices from all across the country so you won't miss a thing.
That's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and we are talking in this hour of Radio Times about what the world is talking about, the life and legacy of Nelson Mandela. He died last night at the age of 95. He had been sick for some time and is being mourned around the world. Joining us now is Trudy Rubin, worldview columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She interviewed Nelson Mandela back in 2000, and Trudy's been a guest on Radio Times many, many times. And Trudy, nice to have you back with us. Radio Times.
Lovely to be here.
And to our listeners, again, any questions or comments or memories that you might have, and he did spend some time here in Philadelphia, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Trudy, one of the things that you have written about Nelson Mandela was that he refused to behave like a big man. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things that people don't recognize so much is that he was beloved for even more than his ability to reconcile black and whites and basically hold South Africa together. He operated differently from so many typical African leaders who regarded, who and still do, their country's natural resources as their personal piggy bank. He was called Tata, a father, because people knew he cared and he wasn't going to milk state money while his country was trying to bring blacks out of poverty, a struggle that's still going on.
He also only served one term, and we know many other leaders in South Africa have stayed on for decades, but he served out the one sole term as South African president.
Right, and you know, there are when I went to South Africa and interviewed him, at the same time I went to Nigeria, and here is a country, Nigeria, that is rich in oil, and yet it has horrible cracked roads, schools without windows. You see people selling oil from jerry cans by the side of the road that they have pilfered from oil pipelines, and that's because so many past leaders have literally milked billions out of oil money. Mandela wanted to present the opposite image and opposite reality of a leader who truly cared about his people and did what he could to advance the country's economy, a difficult situation where the struggle is still going on. And he lived very modestly, unlike the current president, Jacob Zuma, who's also from the ANC, who has channeled tens of millions of dollars of state money into enhancing his lavish home in a dirt-poor region.
And that's something we'll be talking about with our third guest. But I wonder, Trudy, what it was like to interview Nelson Mandela. Many people, myself included, when asked, you know, who would you like to interview? Nelson Mandela was on just about everybody's list. You had a chance to sit down and talk with him. What was that like for you?
It was almost unreal. It was hard to believe that one was actually sitting with Nelson Mandela. I had been in Cape Town, and I had gone to Robben Island and been in the cell. You can walk into the little cell where he lived for so many years. And to meet him, you know, clearly he was already frail, even in 2000. He was sitting in a round sunroom with an imitation thatched roof and wearing a trademark black and white shirt. But there truly was an aura about him, and even though one had heard the kind of statements that he made ever since his release about not seeking revenge, it was just tremendously moving to hear him explain why the leadership of the ANC, and basically impelled by him, after 30 years in prison, as he said, he said to me, we had no time for revenge. We knew we passed through life only once. and we wanted to use the time to solve problems. That's why we avoided bloodshed. I couldn't help thinking, you know, if only somehow that message could be channeled into the brains of so many leaders in other parts of the world.
Indeed. Ahmed Kathrada, who had served prison time with Nelson Mandela, says, and this is quoted in the New York Times today, the first thing to remember about Mandela is that he came from a royal family that always gave him a strength and perhaps a kind of confidence that he was as good as anybody, any white person in South Africa.
Yes, there definitely was dignity about him. No question. Now, at that time, he didn't speak of this, but there was also some frustration because he had stepped down after one term, and he had chosen not to try to play the power behind the throne. And he wanted, at that time, to lead a strong campaign for sex education to try to counter rampant AIDS or HIV infections among young people because of unprotected sex. And the other party leadership didn't want him to do that. They thought it was unseemly. Mm-hmm. And so Graça Machel, he wouldn't speak about that because he would not criticize his colleagues who were now in power. Again, something very unusual. His wife told me and a couple of other journalists in another interview how frustrated he was not to be able to do that. But he was dignified, and he wasn't going to defame others in public.
And he had a child who died of AIDS, so obviously this was a very personal tragedy for him,
yes,
for him as well. Trudy Rubin, our second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, as we remember Nelson Mandela. He died last night at the age of 95. He had been ill for some time, frail for many years now, or a number of years now, and our guest Trudy Rubin interviewed Nelson Mandela back in 2000. She's the Worldview columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And any questions or comments or thoughts, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Trudy Rubin, Nelson Mandela said many times in many different contexts, he was not a saint, and I don't think we shouldn't talk about him, I don't think, in saintly terms on the day after he died, but he was a man with a long and complicated life, several marriages. It sounds as if he had some distance with children, obviously some of that because of the fact that he was in prison for 27 years. But this was a complicated man.
Yes, I think so. And as your previous guest said eloquently, I mean, he had a strategy. He was not just a man with a loving heart. I mean, he spoke of that in the interview. I mean, this was a man who calculated, who had dedicated his life to something. And I can imagine that personal relations suffered, not just during the 27 years when he was locked away, but because of his devotion and his strategic goal to which he was devoted, I could see that impinging on personal relations. I mean, he said that he had planned all those years, but he had planned all those years how to achieve a multiracial South Africa. He said, in single cells, you have the opportunity to think that we don't have outside. Mm. You are able to mold your own emotions, your own morality. But then he had a sense of humor. He said, but I wouldn't advise anyone to go to jail for this.
Indeed. And as Mary Frances Berry was reminding us, this was back in the 1980s, the United States, President Reagan did not support sanctions, was in support of the apartheid regime at the time.
Right. It seems strange looking back because Mandela has such an aura that there's, I think, an assumption from people who don't know the history that, well, of course we would have supported, you know, the ANC it was in exile. It did carry out violent acts because it was trying to overthrow the apartheid regime. And so it was treated like a terrorist organization, and we did not support it. The irony is that although violence was indeed used, the leader
was able to follow a nonviolent strategy to pull off a peaceful transition with the white minority. I mean, the paradox is stunning.
Well, and of course, there was great fear that with a multiracial government and with blacks in greater power in South Africa, there would be violence. Whites would flee the country, but that really didn't happen, Trudy.
No, it didn't happen. And I think one of the most fascinating and fraught issues going forward is the fact that so many South Africans, including many whites who've chosen to stay and also many blacks, worry about whether the moral aura that Mandela cast over the country might somehow, in its absence, that you might have tensions emerging between blacks and whites that he was able to keep a lid on simply by staying alive.
And of course, and I do want to get our second guest in the conversation. In fact, it seems like the appropriate time to do that. And again, talking with Trudy Rubin, a worldview columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She interviewed Nelson Mandela back in 2000. And joining us now is Douglas Foster. He's associate professor of journalism at Northwestern University and wrote a book most recently called After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. In fact, I was a guest on Radio Times talking about that book. And Doug Foster, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be with you, Marty.
And to our listeners, again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Doug, I want to give you a chance just to talk about your thoughts today, the day after the death of Nelson Mandela. What are you thinking about?
Well, it's, you know, as much as you prepare for a day like this, and I suppose if you write a book called After Mandela, you should be prepared for it. You're never quite emotionally, psychologically ready. Look, it's an emotional day, and it's a sobering day, but I don't think it's really a sad day. It's not a day of mourning. This is the triumphal end to a triumphant life. A one-time guerrilla leader, once denounced as a terrorist here in the United States as well as South Africa, survived into his ninth decade long enough to see his country liberated and the new democracy he brought into being secured.
Drew, do you want to respond to that? And I mean, one thinks of Nelson Mandela's life, the freedom fighter, the political prisoner, the president, and the elder statesman. How many people get to do that?
No, not only how many people get to do that, but one of the things that has struck me over and over again is how unique Mandela was. I mean, his role as elder statesman, it was not just that, it was moral conscience. And, you know, I've tried to think of another leader who, in retirement, had such an aura that it was appreciated and respected by most people in the country, including whites. It's hard to think of a retirement like that, of a great leader. And in its absence, one hopes that the moral principles he stood for will not simply vaporize because he was so unique.
Well, do you have worries about this Mandela's South Africa, Doug Foster?
I think that, you know, this is a 20-year experiment fraught from the beginning because, of course, on the same day that democracy arrived, two other big world historical forces walked in the door virtually on the same day, the HIV/AIDS pandemic and world global capitalism. The country got hooked back up to a world system that, at that moment, was increasing inequality everywhere. So whatever else its advantages, the challenge that it gave the new leaders was to try to deliver on the promise that political liberation, the right to vote, would translate into material freedom. And that's where the crunch comes, I think, as South Africa heads into a presidential election next year in which half the population, 25 years old and younger, this is a young society, had no direct experience with apartheid, and has begun, the polls are showing, begun to hold the government to a different kind of account for its performance as opposed to its historic and romanticized and deserved role as the party of liberation.
But as we all know, in this country as well, you know, democracies take time. Democracies are messy, Douglas Foster.
Yes, I think, you know, part of a day of remembering Nelson Mandela ought to be focused on the kind of audacious vision that he and his colleagues had to create a very different kind of society, non-racial, non-sexist, non-homophobic, more egalitarian. And I think, you know, the fact that that vision is still alive in spite of the challenges puts a challenge to us, too. We have a much older democracy, and Mandela was actually very good at turning the table sometimes when people raised questions about how far short the government had fallen there, to say, yes, but let's keep our eye on the prize here and the goal, and what have you done to move us closer to that goal?
Trudy, we have to say goodbye to you in just a moment or two, but I just want to acknowledge the fact that Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk received not just the Nobel Peace Prize, but they also received the Philadelphia Liberty Medal in the same year, in 1993. And an interesting pairing, I was reading through Mandela's speech here in Philadelphia where he talked about the strangeness, but perhaps even the rightness, that these two men, these antagonists in many ways, were being honored with these, with this award in Philadelphia, and then, of course, the Nobel Peace Prize later on.
Yes, it's true. And really, I think what we will learn now is whether what he stood for has truly been inculcated in South Africa, because it was a rare idealism. And he was a pragmatist. He did it consciously. But in a very calculated, strategic way, he was pursuing ideals that one will now see whether they can transcend his death, or whether the leadership of the ANC, which is now being rightly criticized for an economy that doesn't trickle down to the poor, whether a leadership like Jacob Zuma, who has had sexual charges brought against him, they didn't stick, but who has had charges of corruption thrown at him, which seem to have some basis, we'll see whether that leadership can continue to promote those ideals, whether they can outlast Mandela.
Another test then for South Africa, Trudy?
Yes.
Well, we do have to say goodbye to you, and I do want to stay with Douglas Foster for the rest of the hour. And again, we are talking about the life, the legacy, the death of Nelson Mandela. He died yesterday at the age of 95. Trudy Rubin is the Worldview columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she interviewed Nelson Mandela back in 2000. Trudy, as always, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And again, Douglas Foster staying with us for the rest of the hour. He's an associate professor of journalism at Northwestern University, and his most recent book is titled After Mandela, and it's subtitled The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation as we talk about South Africa after Mandela, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send me a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen or an email at radiotimes.org. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Policy Studies that prepares students to take leadership roles in developing policies to address important issues impacting our communities. Students can choose from food and agriculture, sustainability and environment, or community and international development. More information about a Master of Arts in Policy Studies is available online at delval.edu/grad.
The HBO documentary Six by Sondheim, featuring interviews with and music by Stephen Sondheim, debuts Monday. On the next Fresh Air, David Bianculli reviews it, and we feature our 2010 interview with Sondheim. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
the man of the century, the last century.
A man who took history in his hands and bent the arc of the moral universe towards justice.
From prisoner to president, Nelson Mandela and the way forward for Africa and the world. Voices of the people who knew him best on The Takeaway, next time from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and we are talking in this hour of Radio Times about what the world is talking about, the death of Nelson Mandela, what his life signified, what his legacy is about. And our guest, as we close out this hour, is Douglas Foster, and again, Associate Professor of Journalism at Northwestern University. His most recent book is titled After Mandela, The Struggle for Freedom in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. Doug, you mentioned the fact that in South Africa, about half the population is under the age of 25, meaning that they really didn't live under apartheid. Their parents did. Their grandparents certainly did. Where does that leave, I guess, South Africa? The fact that we have so much of the population that doesn't have a personal experience with apartheid.
I think it's an important turning point that the death and the 10 days of mourning that the country has now begun. An opportunity for there to be a kind of cross-generational conversation that hasn't really happened. Returning guerrilla fighters, returning prisoners like Mandela, those who had been active in the uprising inside the country, tended to shield their children and grandchildren from stories of what actually happened during the 70s and 80s in the late stages of apartheid and the violence that was so common. And I think that, you know, all night I spent time talking to South African friends and listening to South African radio and watching television. And from the interviews in the street, there's some evidence that that kind of cross-generational conversation has begun. But it is a challenge for that older generation to figure out what it wants to tell the next, that half of the population that had no direct experience with that peculiar and strange form of racial segregation called apartheid, and where they want this new generation to be able to kind of escape history's grasp and shape a new country according to this vision without having their personalities distorted by apartheid, which, you know, the UN called the crime against humanity.
He served just 5 years as president, as he said he would. But one wonders whether, and I'll put this to you, Douglas Foster, if he had served 10 years, two terms, whether South Africa would be in a better position or in better shape than it is today.
You know, you're asking a question that goes to the idea of contingency in history, and there's a really important possibility looking back that you're raising, which actually goes to the fact that it took the white regime so long to cede power, because the main reason Nelson Mandela resisted the idea that he would be the first president. He actually fought against becoming the presidential candidate and the first head of state. It was because he was so old. He came out of prison in his 70s, and he had a sense that it should go to a younger leader. So I think I just make a little bit of an amendment to the question to say, yes, if he had come out earlier, if the tremendous violence of the late stages of apartheid had not happened, and he had been able to exercise his kind of calming, diplomatic, cross-racial power of moral suasion longer, I think some of the values that we admire and that he advocated might have become more entrenched. I think he was quite right. And that it sent a powerful message, not only just across the continent, but all over the world where politicians overstay their welcome, to say after five years, I'm ready to step away from power, and to do that so cleanly and clearly sent a powerful message.
You wrote, your book in part is about the future of South Africa, obviously after Mandela, the current president, Jacob Zuma. How would you describe his presidency, and just how different is it from Nelson Mandela's?
I think President Zuma has tried to adopt all of the stylistic points that Mandela got so much credit for, being more folksy than the president who came in between, Thabo Mbeki. But he's obviously tremendously challenged on several fronts. Trudy mentioned the rape allegations in the trial, at which he was found not guilty, but repeated charges of corruption, a current investigation by the public protector of monies that were spent on his homestead in his home village. He has been a scandal-plagued leader, and so I think from the outside, it looks like a process of devolution, you know, this one great leader, which unfortunately falls into a kind of trope that outsiders often fall into. You know, there's one good African someplace, and we put Mandela in that slot. Mm-hmm. Thabo Mbeki, being an AIDS denialist, tarnished the office. And Zuma, in his own ways, has tarnished the office as well. I think what that overlooks is a generation of leaders, both in the ANC and in the opposition parties, who are committed, effective, not corrupt, determined to push for a new kind of society. And I think if we look at the three initial presidencies that have taken place in the first 20 years of democracy, as kind of the first president represented that group of people who were imprisoned for long periods of time. The second president, Thabo Mbeki, represented those who had been in exile all over the world, kind of helping to spark that mass movement around the world against apartheid that Trudy mentioned. And this third president came out of the guerrilla movement. Mm-hmm. He was chief of intelligence of the Mkhonto-we Sizwe. He had been in the frontline states as a guerrilla leader. I think in a way that sets the stage for a next leader to come from the ranks of people who stayed inside the country, who were part of that community that is called a very odd word, inziles.
Inziles.
Meaning exiled in your own country. Inziles. There's a whole generation of people in their 50s now who were active in mass democratic movements, who arguably have more experience in grassroots and bottom-up democratic processes than any of the three initial presidents, including Mandela. And I think there's some hope, you know, it's a cautious optimism that I have, that their immersion, their emergence now could be a very, very timely and positive thing.
But there are these very serious challenges. As you mentioned, HIV, there's income inequality, there are allegations of corruption. I mean, there is, and I guess positive signs as well. You've got a growing middle class. It's a very different country from its neighbor, Zimbabwe, which also lived under some of that same history. Does that give you some optimism?
Yeah, I think what you just said gives us both sides of the ledger. You know, on the one hand, tremendous corruption now. The ANC openly talks about it, has crusades against it, et cetera. So there's almost nothing you can say about corruption that isn't being discussed inside the party as well. Tremendous income inequality. And you have to ask the question, you know, how long will people vote and peacefully assemble and protest when 75% of young blacks in a majority black country are unemployed? On the other hand, as you just said, 2 million blacks moving into middle income status. So not enough, but also not nothing. And that's the kind of nuanced look we want to take, not to be as outsiders comparing what's happening to the vision and just saying all is lost, because I don't think that's true. At the same time, we don't want to underestimate the tremendous challenges that that remain in getting closer to that Mandela vision.
I want to pick up on something you said earlier about the challenges of HIV and the challenges of capitalism in South Africa. This going back to when Nelson Mandela became the first black president, that, you know, he didn't dismantle the economic system. He tried to make it more inclusive. Can you expand on what you were saying back then?
Sure. 80% of land and wealth in South Africa is still in white hands, and whites are a minority of between 8 and 9%. So the deal that was really struck 20 years ago, crudely put, after 4 years of negotiation, people forget that from Mandela's release in 1990 to that first election was a very tough negotiation from between liberation forces and the white regime. And a result of that negotiation was an agreement that property rights remained sacrosanct, that there would be no wide-scale, wide nationalization or seizing of wealth or land in exchange for political rights and the right to vote. And I think that balance, you know, is something that Mandela is lionized for all over the world, striking that balance, being able to achieve a peaceful transfer of power. But it came with some consequences, and those are being faced squarely. And I think they will be the centerpiece of the presidential election campaign that begins in January and ends in April, when it'll be 20 years since Mandela was elected.
It's so interesting to learn about all the different parts of Nelson Mandela's extraordinary life, but I was reading in the New York Times today about when he was in prison, the secret negotiations he had with the South African government about his release, about the release of other prisoners, about apartheid itself. These were going on secretly, and no one apparently knew about it, certainly within the ANC or within his group.
Yes, I think that that's a little bit exaggerated.
Is it?
I read the same story. I believe at least he always defended himself as somebody who had been a disciplined member of the party and had, through secret channels, been alerting Oliver Tambo, the then president of the ANC, to what was going on. There were people to Mandela's left who were afraid that Mandela was too soft, that he would give away the store, and were very worried about the fact that he was in conversations behind bars. So I think there was a legitimate concern, and, you know, this is a guy who didn't reach leadership positions by being a patsy,
right,
or being the warm and fuzzy character we celebrate. He was very warm in person, but he also had a steely quality, and he felt very strongly during that period in the 80s that the liberation forces might eventually succeed if they continued with a military strategy of takeover, but what they would inherit would be rubble. And so he was able to take the risk, including in his stature within the movement, to begin talking before that was public at all for years.
Well, I have a couple of minutes before I have to say goodbye. What do you think the lessons of Nelson Mandela and his life is for the United States? And I say that because for many years, this country supported apartheid. The ANC was seen as a terrorist organization, I think, until just a couple of years ago. What is the sort of takeaway, I guess, if we can put it that way, from his life for this country?
Well, I think it's the last thing he said to me the last time I saw him, right after the World Cup in 2010. You know, he was a mischievous person. I took my son to see him at his home in Houghton, which is where he died. And as we walked in the door, he said, "Ah, it's very nice that young people still come around to listen to an old man when he has nothing new to say." Hmm. And it was a joke. We all laughed. But there was a needle in it, too. It said, and not just to South Africans, but to people who supported the South African experiment by opposing apartheid, to pay attention to the constraints placed on developing countries. You know, we've got a world economy in which the rules are stacked for the Chinese to produce all the textiles, for Brazil to grow all the crops, for India to do all the coal centers. There's not a whole lot of room for developing countries to establish the kind of manufacturing jobs that produce middle incomes. This won't sound like a foreign problem to us in the United States now.
Well, you know,
but there are very few ladders up, and part of that is in international hands. It's not a problem that will be solved by South African leaders alone.
Well, on that note, Douglas Foster, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Always good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us as well. And again, we are remembering Nelson Mandela. We're going to close things out with South African musician Hugh Masekela's 1987 song, Mandela, Bring Him Back Home, from the 1994 album called Hope.